So let me just tell you what it is that we're going to talk about today and remind you a little bit about what we talked about last time. Last time we saw a quick introduction to quantum error correcting code, so ways of encoding quantum information so that we could protect against at least some kinds of errors. If we had errors that didn't occur with too high a probability, say according to some model of independent errors, so that it was most likely that if we saw an error, we would just see one error. And then we tried to encode the quantum information so that it would be stored more reliably under the encoding than if we didn't encode it at all. And so we saw this Shor code, which is maybe the simplest example of a code that can correct any one single qubit error acting on any of the physical qubits when you're encoding one logical qubit into, in this case, 9 physical qubits. So today what we're going to see is a framework, a formalism called stabilizer codes, which describes, well, not all of the quantum error correcting codes that you could necessarily think about, but a very large class of codes, and essentially all of the most interesting codes that people think about are examples of stabilizer codes. This was a formalism that was developed by Dan Gottesman, who's faculty here at PI, and work that he did for his PhD thesis. So this is a nice formalism that describes codes, and you'll see that there's a very rich mathematical structure that describes these codes. And then we'll say something, just kind of briefly about fault tolerance, which is about, this is sort of a theory of how you could compute reliably when you have noise. So when you have noisy operations and you're trying to store information, then that's sort of the situation where we just care about error correcting codes. But if we actually want to do computation in a fault tolerant way, that's harder because we have to not only worry about storage errors, but we have to worry about errors that might happen when any of the gates that we're doing. When we do any gates, right? So for now, when we talk about error correction, we're imagining that we can do things like measuring the syndrome perfectly. We don't worry about errors that happen there. But ultimately, when we want to think about fault tolerance, we have to think about errors that could happen while we're performing error correction, for example. Okay. So just a quick reminder. So for the Shor code, we had these two code words. So this was the logical zero state and the logical one state. We'd say these are two code words of the code, and there's some particular way of encoding one logical qubit into these 9 physical qubits, and we kind of argued last time that we could correct against certain x and z errors, and then since y errors are treated independently, we could correct those as well. And then we also had this idea that if we could correct any poly error, actually we could correct a general error. So if we could correct any one qubit poly error, we can correct any one qubit error actually of any kind. Okay, so this is one way of thinking about a code, just writing down explicitly what its code words are. But it's not really the nicest way to think about how you represent a code. There's a nicer way, which involves this stabilizer formalism. So there's something that we call the stabilizer of the code that actually specifies what the code is. And in many ways, it's a better way to think about what the code is. So what we're going to do is we're going to think about, what are the operators that we would be measuring in order to figure out what the error syndrome is, right? So remember, we had this notion of an error syndrome, which was some kind of information that we could measure about the state, which would tell us only about the errors and not about the data. So the syndrome should not tell us anything about whether we're in the zero state or the one state, the logical zero or the logical one state, but it should give us information about whether errors occurred. So let's do this. So let's consider what operators we measure to determine the syndrome. Okay, so for the most part so far we've been thinking about, when we think about a measurement, we think about measuring in some basis, but there's also this very familiar notion, hopefully, in quantum mechanics, where we can think about measuring an operator, right? Measuring an observable. So an observable is just some Hermitian operator, and when we make a measurement of that operator, the outcome is one of its eigenvalues, and so what we're doing is we're just projecting onto one of the eigenspaces of that operator. So that's the sense in which I mean measuring an operator. And so the operators that we're going to measure when we think about determining the syndrome for some error-correcting code will always be poly operators. So I want to define something called the poly group, which will come up all over the place. So the n qubit poly group which we'll just denote Pn, is going to be the set of Well, it's going to be generated by single qubit poly operators acting on any of the n qubits. So it's just going to consist of tensor products of n poly operators, but then also we could in general have some global phase. So so consists of so tensor products of n operators that are all poly operators or the identities, so from I, X, Y, or Z. And then, you know, we want to think about it as a group. So you'll see that this stabilizer formalism is all about, so it's a sort of a group theoretic formalism. And so we might think about the group of poly operators. And of course, if we start to multiply together poly operators, we can get phases, right? So for example, if you multiply X times Y, you get I times Z. So you can get a phase of I, and of course, then you can get a phase of plus or minus 1 or plus or minus I, and it's easy to see that those are the only phases that you get. So it consists of these n operators with global phase plus or minus 1 or plus or minus I. Okay, so for the most part, we'll be worrying about, you know, strings of these operators where actually the global phase is just plus 1, and for a lot of purposes, you can think about what happens when you just forget about this global phase. So it won't actually play a very serious role. But if we talk about what the poly group is, it also includes the possibility of having these phases. Okay? So the poly group, I mean, the poly group is some non-abelian group, but actually if you mod out by the center, so you don't care about what this global phase is, it's actually an abelian group. And that's sort of the thing which is really going to matter for us the most. Yes?
When you say tensor products of operators with global phase, it sounds to me kind of like the tensor product itself has a global phase.
So, I mean, what I mean is that so P in Pn has the form P equals, you know, alpha times, A1 tensor, A2 tensor, dot, tensor, An, where alpha is in, you know, 1 minus 1, I minus I. That's what I mean. So there's some global phase for the whole thing. I mean, you don't have to think about it as being associated with them individually because it's a global phase. Okay, so this is the poly group. And now what we want to think about are, you know, what are the operators that we would measure to determine the syndrome of some error-correcting code. So maybe let's do some examples. Think about what these operators that we would measure to find the syndrome are. So for example, let's think about the bit flip code. And remember, we can think about this as a quantum code. It's just that it wouldn't correct against phase errors. It would only correct against bit flip errors. And so we could think about, you know, what are the operators that we would measure to determine the syndrome. So remember what the syndrome was for the bit flip code. It consisted of the parity of the first and the second bit, and the parity of the second and the third bit in the computational basis, because this code is just protecting against information in the computational basis. Okay, so what are the operators that we should measure to get that information out? The poly operators that we should measure. So for example, you know, so one of the things we might want to determine is the parity of bits 1 and 2. So what operator should we measure to get to have its eigenvalues tell us something about the parity of the first and the second bit? Yeah, that's right. So it should be like this operator. So in other words, it's I'm going to not write this tensor product symbol, and I'm not even going to write like a subscript or anything to say what the operators, which qubit the operators act on. I'll just write them in order because we'll be writing things like this a lot, and that'll simplify things. So by this I mean, you know, Z acting on the first qubit, tensor Z acting on the second qubit, tensor I acting on the third qubit. Okay, and the eigenvalues of this operator are going to tell us exactly, you know, whether the parity of the first two bits is even, corresponding to the eigenvalue plus 1, or odd, corresponding to the eigenvalue minus 1. Right, so before, when we talked about the syndrome, the syndrome was a string of bits, and we had, you know, kind of 0 corresponding to even parity and 1 corresponding to odd parity. Now when we talk about the eigenvalues of this operator, well, the eigenvalues are plus or minus 1. Right, so the eigenvalues of the individual poly operators are just plus or minus 1, so the eigenvalue of this tensor product of poly operators will also be plus or minus 1. So this is the convention that we're going to actually be using from now on, that the eigenvalues, the eigenvalues will be plus or minus 1. So the syndrome will consist of pluses and minuses that tell us something about what error occurred. Okay? So there'll be one bit of the syndrome, which is either a plus or a minus, corresponding to measuring that operator. Okay? And then we also need the parity of bits 2 and 3. And so obviously that just corresponds to the operator IZZ. So this is some concise way of writing down what it is that you would like to measure if you wanted to determine the syndrome of the bit flip code. And we could do this for other codes. So for example, you know, suppose we want to do this for the Shor code, the 9-qubit code. What would that look like? Well, remember, we have this outer and this inner code. So the outer code was basically the bit flip code for each of these blocks. And so we'll have an operator that looks like this for each of the blocks. So we'll have, for example, we have this operator. And the eigenvalues of this operator will tell us about what the parity of the first two bits in the computational basis is. So that's some information from the syndrome. You know, that's some information that should be in the syndrome so that we can figure out what error occurred and what we have to correct. And similarly, we have like this, with identities everywhere else. And maybe I won't write all the identities because it would take a lot of time. But everywhere I don't write something, there's an identity. And then we have the same thing for every block. So we have, for the second block, we have this. And for the third block, we have this. OK, so now we have six operators that we have to measure to determine some information from the syndrome. And then there should also be some information about phase flips, right? Some information that will tell us about where phase flips occurred. And remember that what we just wanted to know was something about, whether we had, we want to know in which block we have a plus or a minus. It's not possible to tell, say, if a phase error occurred, whether it occurred on the first qubit or the second qubit, because those two things have the same effect. They both flip this minus to a plus. So we just want the information about, the parities of the phase between this block and this block, and between this block and this block. And maybe it's not quite as obvious to see this just looking at it, but it turns out that the operators you want to measure are the following. So x is on the first 6 qubits, and then we would have i's on the last 3 qubits. Or we could have x's, so i's on the first 3 qubits, and x's on the last 3 qubits. OK, so these are the 8 poly operators that we would like to measure if we want to determine the syndrome of the code. So if we want to do error recovery, we would measure these 8 operators. That would give us a syndrome, and that would give us the information we need to recover from any one qubit error. Okay. So these operators are examples of what are called the stabilizer of a code. So these operators form the stabilizer of the code, or rather, we would say that they generate the stabilizer. The stabilizer is actually a group, and so what we're going to see is that actually, so far we've just been thinking about this as the operators that we would measure for some particular code, where the code is specified by writing down what the code words are, right? So here, to say what the code was, we just said these are the code words. But actually, there's a sense in which you can think about the stabilizer as actually specifying the code. Right? So the stabilizer is not just something that you can derive from the set of code words, but actually, if you know what the stabilizer is, from that you can figure out what the code space is, what the code words are. So let's see how that happens. OK, so one thing to observe is that actually the code words, so say in the example of the Shor code, are all in the plus 1 eigenspace, in fact, the simultaneous plus 1 eigenspace of all of these operators. Another thing you can check is that these operators actually all commute with one another. So you can simultaneously diagonalize all of them. And if you look at what their plus 1 eigenspace is, well, that's exactly the thing spanned by these two operators. Yes?
Is it true in general that all the operators in the stabilizer are simultaneously diagonalized?
That will always be the case. Yeah, that will be a general feature. Yes?
The last two
The last two stabilizer operators? Well, I mean, I don't think I gave them a name. These are just the operators that you would measure to get information about where phase errors occurred. But it's about where the phase errors occur. I mean, this code has the, you know, a special feature, which is that we have separate stabilizer operators that are telling us where bit flip errors occurred and where phase flip operators occurred. That's not always the case, but it's the case for this code. We'll see an example of a code where that's not the case later on. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so, yes, another question, good. Indeed.
And when you say the plus one eigenspace, do you mean that, so not only do, not only are these share eigenspaces, but also the plus one eigenspace of each operator is the plus one eigenspace of every other operator?
No, that's not true, right? So the plus one eigenspace of every operator is exactly, is going to give you exactly half the space, right? So, I mean, So, you know, if we consider, for example, something that's just one non-trivial poly operator and everything else is the identity, that operator, that one non-trivial poly operator has eigenvalues plus one and minus one, and each of them is going to, you know, it sort of specifies one degree of freedom that's going to cut the space in half. So exactly half of the space, you know, will consist of, will be the, in other words, the dimension of the plus one eigenspace will be the same as the dimension of the minus one eigenspace. And that's true in general for all of these poly operators. So it's only when you put them all together that you cut the space down to something which is pretty small. I mean, in fact, every time you add a non-redundant generator, it cuts the space in half. And okay, I mean, this is something that we're going to see later on, but since you mentioned it now, let me say it now. I mean, so it's kind of no coincidence that the Shor code encodes one qubit, and there are eight stabilizer operators, right? So we have nine qubits. Every time we add a non-redundant generator, it cuts the size of the space in half. So that says we'll have dimension two left after we add eight operators, and that's why we still have exactly one logical qubit when we put in the eight operators. Okay, we'll say a little bit more about that later on. Other questions? You want the simultaneous plus one eigenspace of all the operators. So you simultaneously diagonalize them, and you look for the operators that have eigenvalue plus one for all of them. OK. So, so this thing is going to have a special name. It's going to be called the stabilizer of a code, right? So a code will consist of, you can think about a code as being specified by a bunch of code words. And then there's some code space, which is the, you know, the subspace that's spanned by the code words. But you can think about that also as specifying a stabilizer. So here's the definition. So the stabilizer of a code is some set that in general we'll write as S. So that's going to be the set of all the poly operators. So we'll write these things as M. So these will be n qubit poly operators if it's a code that is encoding things into states of n qubits. So for example, n is 9 for the Shor code. So this will be the set of all the poly operators that that map so m psi to psi for all code words psi. So the code words will always be eigenvectors with eigenvalue plus one of all of the operators in the stabilizer. And you could think of, you know, coming up with the stabilizer by first specifying the code and, you know, and then from it, you know, looking for all the operators that give you eigenvalue plus one. And that's what we're going to call the stabilizer. Okay. So something that you can see without too much work, I won't prove it now, but you can think about it, is that the stabilizer is actually an abelian group. So this is an abelian group. And furthermore, actually, you know, not only is this an abelian group, but if you specify any abelian subgroup of the poly group, subject to a small technical condition, so if you specify basically any abelian subgroup of the poly group, that will actually define a code. So So in fact, any abelian subgroup, so the condition is that minus identity should not be in the subgroup, so with minus the identity, not an element of S. Kind of clearly we don't want to have minus the identity in the stabilizer anyway, because we couldn't have any plus one eigenvectors if that were the case of all the operators in the stabilizer, right? Because this thing has eigenvalue minus one for everything. So I mean, we wouldn't want to do that anyway. So any abelian subgroup S that doesn't have that doesn't include minus I, so this is a subgroup of Pn, specifies a code. And what is that code? So we're going to write that as T of S. And that's just going to be the set of all of the code words that are plus one eigenvalues of all of the elements in S. So this is going to be all of the states psi such that m psi equals psi for all m in S. So we can go the other way around, and we can think about the stabilizer as specifying the code, and this is now what we're going to do. Okay, good. So, right, so yeah, this is where I was going to mention this other thing. So that, so notice that the dimension of this thing T of S is always going to, well, it's always going to be a power of 2. This is going to be of, this is going to be, 2 to the R. So if it's 2 to the R, then we would say that this is a code that encodes R qubits. And here, here R is equal to n minus k, where k is the number of generators. Well, it's the number of, non-redundant generators. And this is exactly for the reason that I was saying before, that, every time we add some non-redundant generator, that's going to cut down the size of the remaining space in half. And so the number of qubits that we're left with after we add k generators will be exactly n minus k. Okay. Right. So yeah, so I mean, I guess I did this example already, that in the short code, we have 9 physical qubits, we have 8 generators, and so we're left with one logical qubit at the end of the day. Okay, so the next thing to see is that if we want to figure out where the errors occurred, these correspond exactly to the eigenvalues of the stabilizer operators. I mean, this is the way we were thinking about it before, but let's look at that in a little bit more detail. So the eigenvalues of the stabilizer operators, so these give the syndrome, and this specifies, it gives us information, about errors. So one thing to see about the elements of the polygroup, and this is kind of a basic fact that we're going to use all over the place, is that if we take two elements of the polygroup, they always either commute or anti-commute, right? So if I take, the identity with anything else, of course it commutes. If I take a polyoperator with itself, of course it commutes. And if I take, x with y or x with z, they anti-commute, right? So like x times z is minus z times x. And, by extension, the same will be true if I take any tensor product of polyoperators. So every time I take two polyoperators, these will be things that either commute or anti-commute. And now what I have is, I have some stabilizer operators that stabilize the code. Incidentally, I mean, I guess you can see, where this name stabilizer comes from, right? These things are plus one eigenvectors, so they're operators that leave the code states the same. So the code states are stabilized by these operators. Okay, so we have these operators that stabilize the code words, and then we also have errors that we want to worry about, and those errors are themselves polyoperators. So something that we can think about is whether a given error either commutes or anti-commutes with some element of the stabilizer. And it will always be one or the other, because two polyoperators either commute or anti-commute. So these are the two possibilities, and let's see what happens in this case. Okay, so consider some error E. So this might be some error that we want to correct. And maybe we will be able to, and maybe we won't. Let's consider some stabilizer operator M. So this is some element of the stabilizer S of some code, and some code word psi. Okay, and now there are two possibilities for what could happen. The error could either commute, or it could anti-commute with the stabilizer operator M. So if it's the case that they commute, so if the error commutes with the stabilizer, so if their commutator is zero, so E times M is equal to M times E, then what can I say about what happens when I apply this error to the code word, right? So I could think about the state that I get if I apply the error to the code word. This is the state that I would have if that error occurred. And let's think about what the eigenvalue would be of the stabilizer operator M. Well, so then M acting on E times psi, because M and E commute, is just E times M times psi. Okay, but what's M times psi? It's just psi, right? Because psi is, you know, is stabilized by the stabilizer. So this is just E times psi. So this says that E times psi is also a plus one eigenvector of M. So psi was a plus one eigenvector of M, and E times psi is also a plus one eigenvector of M. So this is giving us a plus one eigenvector. So that's sort of a bad thing, right? Because the situation hasn't changed, right? Before we had some state which was, you know, in the plus one eigenspace of this operator. It's still in the plus one eigenspace, and so that means that something has happened that we won't be able to tell, at least as far as this stabilizer operator is concerned. Of course, maybe one of the other stabilizer operators helps. Okay, then the other possibility is that they could anti-commute. So if the anti-commutator is zero, in other words, if E times M is minus M times E, then, well, exactly the opposite thing happens. So then M acting on E times psi is, you know, this is minus E times M times psi, but psi is a plus one eigenvector of M. So this gives us minus E times psi. So that says that E times psi is actually a minus one eigenvector. So here I guess I should write like E psi is a of M. Right? So what this says is that, you know, there's another way to think about what's going to happen to the syndrome, what the syndrome is going to be corresponding to, you know, how the syndrome will reflect the particular error E. It's telling us information about whether, well, it's, you know, it's going to, the syndrome is going to be plus if E and M commute, and it's going to be minus if E and M anti-commute. So we can think about this, you know, this bit of the syndrome is telling us exactly this, whether whether the error commutes or anti-commutes with that particular stabilizer operator. Okay. Okay, so now I want to define another object which will be important for understanding these error correcting codes, which is what's called the normalizer of some code. Now, you know, we're going to be working in this picture where we think of the code as being specified by the stabilizer. So we can think of the normalizer as being a function of the stabilizer, but we'll call it the normalizer of the code. So the normalizer of S is, so we'll write it as N of S, and these will be the operators that commute with everything in S. So so this will be the set of all the poly operators that commute with every element of the stabilizer. So this is a general kind of group theoretic concept that whenever you have some group, remember S is an abelian group, you can talk about its normalizer, and this is what the definition is in general. Okay, but let's think, you know, for now, just in the context of error correcting codes, it consists of all of the operators that commute with every element of the stabilizer. Okay, and you could think about these elements of the normalizer as possible errors that might happen. So, So now, you know, this is not just the operators that commute with some particular stabilizer operator M, but the ones that commute with every possible stabilizer operator M. So that means that, you know, in particular, if you compute the syndrome, well, I guess I should ask you. So if you compute the syndrome of an element of the normalizer, so you have an error occurs, which is an element of the normalizer, what is the syndrome going to be? So syndrome for an error E, which is an element of the normalizer. So what is it? Yeah, it's plus one for everything, right? So it's you know, so the syndrome in general is some, you know, long list of pluses and minuses, one for every element of the stabilizer. So this is just going to be plus, plus, plus. And that's the same as the syndrome of you know, the identity, right? So in other words, if this happens, we can't tell that this error E has occurred. So these are sort of errors that we actually won't be able to cope with. And, you know, so this normalizer is important because it tells us what the set of undetectable errors is. And then if we want to know what the set of detectable errors is, of course, it's, you know, it's the complement. So now the set of undetectable errors So right now we're just talking about detecting errors. We'll talk about correcting errors in a second. But now we just want to know whether an error had occurred, right? And we'll know that some error has occurred if we get some non-trivial syndrome. So the set of undetectable errors is, well, you might think at first it's just N of S. But actually, you should sort of think about it as a little bit less than that, right? So we should take something away. So what should we take away? Yes. Definitely we should take away the identity, good, because the identity is not really an error. I mean, if the identity happens, that's great. But in general, there could actually be more than the identity that we should take away. There are other things that we should also take out sometimes. It could be that the identity is the only thing. That's the only thing that we should always take out. But sometimes there's even more. The whole stabilizer, exactly, good. So we should take out the stabilizer because you know, if we have some stabilizer operator that acts on a code word, it doesn't change the code word. So that's not an error. Right? It just leaves the code word the same. So you could have you know just some kind of inherent, you know, robustness against particular errors just because those errors are elements of the stabilizer, right? So that's just not going to hurt you at all if you have some element of the stabilizer, you know, that's possibly not even the identity that that acts on the code. Now, you know, this may not help you very much because, like, for example, if you look at the, you know, the stabilizer of the short code, like you look, there are these, you know, wait six errors, right? These six X's. You know, if you were to happen to have X's on all the, you know, first six qubits, then, you know, that would not actually affect things. Maybe that doesn't help you so much because maybe a wait six error is not so likely. But, you know, if we want to be, you know, complete, we should take those things out. Yes?
So just make sure, so the reason they're undetectable is it because it would, for example, change a 0L to 1L?
That's right. That's exactly right. So these are things, well, not only that, but it does that without revealing itself in the syndrome. Right? So the things that take a code word to another code word, you know, are going to be the poly operators that do that are going to be the things that, you know, are not in S, right? So the things in S are things that fix the code words. And you know, they really have a plus one. The eigenvector is really plus one. So even if you have any superposition, they're going to keep you within the code space. They're going to keep the state. Sorry, they're going to keep the state exactly the same. But you know, things in N of S are the things where the syndrome is going to be trivial, so you just won't be able to see the error. Right. So things that are in N of S take away S are the things that where the syndrome doesn't reveal that an error has occurred and a genuine error has occurred. You know, the state could have been moved around. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is the set of undetectable errors. So of course, you know, the set of detectable errors are going to be the ones in the complement of this set. So now we have some way of telling whether we can detect an error. But we don't just want to detect errors. We also want to be able to correct errors, right? We want errors to be distinguishable in such a way that we can actually perform a correction. So in order to understand what the set of correctable errors is, we have to have some further condition. It's going to be harder in general to, you know, tell whether to correct some error than just to be able to detect it. And so for this, there's something that's called sometimes the quantum error correction condition. So there's a more general version of this that that's not necessarily specific to stabilizer codes, but this condition is a little bit simpler if we just talk about stabilizer codes. And so the quantum error correction condition is going to be a condition on a set of errors, right? So here we could talk about whether a specific error was detectable or not. But to talk about correcting errors, we can't say that we can correct one error in isolation without thinking about the whole set of possible errors we might want to correct, because being able to correct errors has something to do with the distinguishability of different errors. So we have to think about a whole set of errors. So a set of errors, let me call this script D, so this is some subset of the Pauli group, is correctable if, so here's what the condition is. So for all operators E and F in the set of errors that we might want to correct, so E dagger F is not an element of this set. And the reason for this is just that you want to be able to use the information from the syndrome to tell which error occurred. Right? So if we want to be able to correct these errors, so to distinguish errors E and F, it must be that they have distinct syndromes. So they must have distinct syndromes, because that's how we figure out what error occurred, is by measuring the syndrome. And so, if the syndrome of the syndromes of E and F are, well, let's say that they're the same. That's kind of the bad case. We don't want them to be the same. When are they the same? Well, they're the same if and only if E dagger F has a trivial syndrome. Right? E dagger F is some other Pauli operator, and remember that the syndrome is telling us where things either commute or anti-commute. So if these things are going to be the same exactly when it could be that we have two pluses here, and that would be fine. We could also have two minuses here, and that would be fine. And if we have two minuses here, then those two minuses would cancel in the syndrome of E dagger F. And again, E dagger F would have a syndrome of plus one for that operator. And the only way we're going to get a minus one in the syndrome of E dagger F is if E and F differ in that position. Okay, so that explains this. So yeah, question? Yeah, this is the trivial syndrome.
I'm sorry, I still don't understand why we took the Hamiltonian conjugate.
I mean, we're ultimately going to think about one of these things acting to the left, I guess, but maybe that's the right way to think about it. But it's not going to make a big difference, because actually, these things are always going to be Pauli operators. This is just going to be some complex conjugation. The syndrome is always plus one or minus one, so it's not actually going to affect anything. So I think you could not write it, and it would be OK. But there's sort of a reason for writing it, which is that maybe you should think about, if you want to think about the inner product between two code words, if these two errors, the inner product between the different possible states that you get, if you think about F acting on the code word and E acting on the code word, that's the expectation of E dagger F in that state that you're considering. So I don't know. It doesn't actually really affect much. Okay, so this is the case if and only if E dagger F has trivial syndrome. And when does E dagger F have trivial syndrome? Well, that's exactly when it's in N of S. So this is the case if and only if E dagger F is an element of N of S. Okay, but now what about this takeaway S part? Because I said, the condition for it to be correctable was that it was not in N of S takeaway S. So what does it mean if E dagger F is in S? Well, if E dagger F is an element of the stabilizer, what this means is that, so E dagger F psi is going to be psi for all psi in the code space. So in other words, this is true if and only if e psi equals f psi for all code words psi. Right? So what that says is that the action of the errors, e and f, is the same on the state. So it could be some non-trivial action. It could move the states around. But what it does to the two states is the same. And that says that actually we don't need to distinguish those errors because, you know, the action of the error is the same. So we can do the same recovery for both of those errors. Right? So we don't need to distinguish them. So we can use the same recovery. Okay, and we've seen an example of this already, right? Remember, we saw this in the Shor code, right? In the Shor code, if we talked about a Z error acting on, say, either the first qubit or the second qubit, that had exactly the same effect. So those are two distinct errors, and they do exactly the same thing to the code. So we can't distinguish them, but we don't want to distinguish them because, you know, we don't need to distinguish them because we can correct them in exactly the same way. Namely, we just need to fix the phase, you know, by acting with a Z on any of these three qubits, and that will do the same thing. So there's a name for, you know, this sort of effect when this happens in a quantum code. This is kind of a uniquely quantum thing. There's a whole theory of classical error correcting codes, and this phenomenon doesn't occur for classical error correcting codes. So this is what's called, this is an example of what's called a degenerate code when you have a code when this happens. So when this happens, we say a code is degenerate. And so the Shor code is an example of a degenerate code. Okay, questions at this point? Yes?
Degeneracy is the same property of codes, but is given by characteristic of the errors that you have.
Yeah, it's really not just a property of the code. I mean, usually we say it's a property of the code, but strictly speaking, that's not the right way to say it. It's really a property of the code with respect to a certain set of errors, right? Because it only makes sense to talk about this if you have an error model in mind. So if you had some crazy error model, it could be that the code was not degenerate, even though it was degenerate for this error model. But usually the kinds of errors that we think about will be, you know, low-weight Pauli errors, and we want to correct errors, as many low-weight errors as we can. So when we think about that, maybe you can talk about it being degenerate, kind of independent of the error model, if you have in mind that what you always want to do is correct, say, k qubit errors for as large as possible at k. Yeah, that's what people often do. And in fact, I think that leads in nicely to the next thing that I wanted to mention, which is this notion of the distance of a code. So this is another important property of a code called its distance. So this is going to be the smallest weight of any operator in the set of undetectable errors. So this is the minimum over the set of, well, the of the weight of any operator E, where E is an element of n of s take away s. So here I have to define what I mean by the weight. So the weight is just the number of non-identity Pauli operators. In other words, you know, genuine errors, like you have bits actually errors actually occurring on those qubits. Right? Yes. That's right. It's the minimum over, you know, over all E. So it's, yeah.
So the way of E being the number of non-identity Pauli operators
in E.
In the test product of Pauli operators.
That's right. So for example, you know, I, X, I, Z, I, you know, is a weight 2 error. Okay. So, you know, the distance of a code tells us something about how hard it is to correct, well, how hard it is to detect, you know, errors from that code. So it tells us, you know, if we know that the distance is d, then it tells us that if we have more than d errors, then we can definitely detect that error. Okay, but again, remember that for most purposes, what we care about is not just error detection, but error correction, right? So we want to actually be able to tell what error has occurred so we can correct it, or, you know, modulo this degeneracy issue that sometimes we don't actually care what error occurred. We just need enough information that we can figure out what correction we should do. Okay, but so there's some condition, however, that says that if the distance of a code is you know, at least d, that tells us something about how many errors we can correct. Or in other words, let me put it the other way around. So to correct any t qubit error, it suffices to have distance d equals, well, maybe you can tell me. Right? So suppose, you know, I just know what the distance of the code is, and I want to say that that distance is such that I can correct any t qubit error. How big does d have to be?
T plus 1.
It should be?
T plus 1.
Very close. So it should be 2t plus 1. So what is the reason for this? I mean, what you should think about is sort of, you know, you really want the errors to be distinguishable. Well, if the errors are distinguishable, that would be a sufficient condition, certainly, for you to be able to, you know, correct the errors. And so, you know, you can think about this t as like the radius of a ball around the error, right? So this t is like maybe I can even draw some picture. I mean, it's kind of a vague picture. But say you have some ball of radius t around every code word. So here, this is a code word. Sorry, code word. And they have, if you have a ball of radius t around every code word, then certainly you'll be able to, you know, correct errors, any t qubit error, because it'll keep you within the ball, and these balls won't overlap. And so what you need is that the distance between the code words is bigger than 2t. So maybe you were just thinking about the difference between like the radius and the diameter, you know. So like the you know, if the radius of this ball is t, then you're good. And so what you need is that the distance is at least 2t plus 1. Well, I guess here I should write greater than or equal to, because of course if the distance is bigger, that's only better. Okay. So this is the notion of the distance of a code. And so from the distance, we can say something about how many errors it corrects. I mean, of course, this is a sufficient condition to be able to correct t errors, but it's certainly not a necessary condition because, you know, we saw there when we have degenerate codes, we can even have cases where there's common points in these balls, and still we can correct those errors. So. Okay, so maybe now I should give you some examples of codes. We've already seen some, but let's you know, think again about what they are in terms of the stabilizer formalism and these parameters of the code. Oh, and there's some notation here that I should mention. So a code that encodes k qubits into n qubits and that has this distance d, this is sometimes called an NKD code. And this is usually written in brackets, sometimes in double brackets. NKD code. So this is just some way of writing parameters. So in the theory of classical error correcting codes, this is written with single brackets. When you have a code that encodes k bits into n bits and has distance d, then you say it's an NKD code. And we use kind of the same notation quantumly, and sometimes to distinguish the classical and quantum cases, we use these double brackets. Okay, so in terms of this, I can mention just some examples and what their parameters are. So the Shor code, you know, we've already seen what the code words are and explicitly what the stabilizer is. So I won't write that again. But this is it's a 913 code. Okay, so it encodes one qubit one logical qubit into 9 physical qubits, and it has distance 3. And that, you know, we saw that having distance 3 was a sufficient condition to be able to correct any one qubit error. And in fact, that's the case for this shortcode. Okay. So maybe I'll mention some other codes. We won't kind of go into much detail about them here, but you'll have some exercises where you'll get to think more about them, and also about, you know, more general codes and how you can construct them and what their properties are. So there's something called the Steen code, which is in some sense an even better code, in the sense that it uses fewer physical qubits to have the same error properties. So this is a 713 code. Of course, the short code could correct some multi-qubit errors, so maybe the Steen code won't be able to correct as many multi-qubit errors. But if the goal is just to correct arbitrary single-qubit errors, this code does better in the sense that it only needs 7 qubits to encode one logical qubit. And I can tell you what the stabilizer operators are. So I won't write down what the code words are, but because it's actually a little bit of a mess. But the stabilizer is actually a more concise way to say what the code is, and it's the following. So, okay, so how many poly operators am I going to write down? Just to check if you're following. 6, exactly, because the number of operators will be exactly n minus k. Good. So here it's x, 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 I, I. And then x, x, I, x, x, I. And then we have, I think, alternating x's and i's. So xi, 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 x. And then we have exactly the same things with the x's replaced by z's. So z, 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 I, z, z, I, z, z, I, z, I, z, I, z, I, z. So now you might be thinking, like, who ordered that? I just, like, wrote down some random table of i's, x's, and z's. But there's actually a nice way to think about where this code comes from, and it's actually a similar way that you can think about where the Shor code comes from, which is that there are ways of combining classical codes to make quantum codes. And in particular, there's this formalism of what are called CSS codes, Kaldebrank-Shor-Steen codes, that basically takes known classical error correcting codes and combines them in a certain way to separately correct bit flip and phase flip errors and create some quantum code. So these are what are called CSS codes. And they have a lot of nice properties. In particular, the Steen code has some particularly nice properties for trying to come up with fault tolerant constructions. So when we talk a little bit about fault tolerance, one thing that, I mean, we won't see any details, but if you were to look at the details, you would see that many of the constructions of fault-tolerant protocols will actually use the Steen code. Well, sometimes other codes too. Okay, that's not what I want. That's the rear one. This is not what I wanted either, though, because now this board is fixed. You'd think I would have figured this out by now. Okay, I guess we're just going to deal with having that one at the top. Yes, question? For the Steen code, yeah? So first of all, the reason there's a 1, so the reason that it encodes one logical qubit is that I have 6 generators. And so if I start out with 7 qubits and I specify 6 non-redundant generators, I'm left with 1 qubit of information. In other words, the code space is the simultaneous +1 eigenspace of all those operators, and that's a 2-dimensional space. So that's just because I started out with, 2 to the 7 dimensions, and every time I had an operator, I cut it in half. And I did that 6 times. So I have a qubit left at the end. So that's the reason for the 1. The reason for the three is not as obvious, and you would have to analyze the code. The fact that this code corrects one error, I mean, you would have to, you basically, I mean, something that you could do, maybe it's not the best way to do it, but one thing you could do would be take all the possible, you know, one qubit errors. So there are, if you just worry about, you know, you don't have to worry about the identity on everything. So you have x, y, and z for every one of the qubits. So that's 3 times 7, so that's 21 things. So make a table with, you know, it has 21, you know, rows corresponding to every one of the possible errors that could occur. And then, you know, compute what the syndrome is for every one of those possible errors, right? So the syndrome is some 7-bit string. So write down, you know, all of those syndromes and show that they're all distinguishable from each other. So this is a non-degenerate code, so in this case, they're actually all distinguishable from each other. Yes, is there another? Oh, you're just scratching your head. Good. Okay, so I want to mention, you know, one other example of a code, and then actually maybe we'll have to talk about fault tolerance quickly next time. But I want to mention that actually, in fact, there's a better code if you want to. So if your goal is to, you know, encode one logical qubit into some number of physical qubits such that you can correct any one qubit error that occurs, you might ask, you know, what's the smallest number of physical qubits you could do that with, right? So we saw you could do it with 9. But in fact, you can do better. You can do it with only 7 qubits. But it turns out that 7 is not the best you can do, that you can get by with a smaller code. And it turns out that the best you can do is 5. So you can encode one qubit into 5 physical qubits. And this gives you what's cleverly named the 5-qubit code. So this is a 513 code. And it has the following stabilizer. So now I'm going to write down only 4 operators, right? Because I have 5 qubits, and I want to specify a 2-dimensional code space. So it has the following stabilizer. So x, z, z, x, i, and cyclic permutations of this. So x, z, z, x, i, x, z, z, x, i, x, z, z, x, i. Now, at this point, you may say, well, you're not done, right? Because you said you would take the cyclic permutations of this, and there's one more. But actually, that one would be redundant. So actually, that one you could write as the product of these 4. So it is an element of the stabilizer, but you don't need to write it down if you want to make a complete list of the stabilizer operators that are, you know, that are not redundant and that specify what the code space is. So this specifies a 2-dimensional code space. And this code, you can show, can correct any single qubit error. So again, to show that, I mean, it's not obvious, but you could, you know, you could check what all of the syndromes are corresponding to all the possible single qubit errors that could occur and see that they're all distinguishable. Okay, questions? Okay, so since we're pretty much out of time, I think probably I should stop there. So what I'll do next time is I'll say a little bit quickly about fault tolerance. So you know, let me just say quickly what the idea is. So you know, for fault tolerance, we want to be able to store information such that you know, it'll be protected even if we do gates, and even if we worry about errors that occur, say, when we're doing the measurement of the syndrome or when we're trying to do error recovery. So it's a much more challenging task, but it turns out that you can do this, and there's a nice theorem called the threshold theorem that says that basically, as long as your error level is small enough, you'll be able to compute reliably, actually for an arbitrarily long time, by using some kind of concatenated error correction. So I'll say a little bit about that briefly next time, and then we'll talk about quantum key distribution, and that'll be, unfortunately, all that we have time for. Okay, so see you tomorrow.